Okay, welcome everybody. Hello. Welcome to today's online event, which is held at the International Inequalities Institute. And our event today is entitled Households, Inequalities and Care, Lockdown Experiences from the UK, New Zealand and India. And today's event is part of the International Inequalities Institute seminar series, and it will last for an hour. So we'll finish by 1:30 British time. Just to introduce myself, I'm Insa Koch. I'm an Associate Professor of Law and Anthropology at the LSE, and I'll be chairing today's event. And I'm really pleased to welcome our speakers for today. So we've got Dr. Alpa Shah, who's Associate Professor of Anthropology at the LSE, and also the Research Theme Leader of the Global Economies of Care Network at the International Inequalities Institute at the LSE. We've got Professor Laura Baer, Professor of Anthropology, also at the LSE, and Dr. Nick Long, Associate Professor of Anthropology, again at the LSE. Now, all three of them have been doing research on COVID-19 and the pandemic, and today this is what they will be presenting on. In particular, they will be talking about the need to center an understanding of the household in policy making as well as in politics if we are to mitigate the inequalities that we're seeing today. And all three of them will be using case studies from their own anthropological and ethnographic fieldwork, looking at case studies from the UK, New Zealand, and India. Before I hand over to the speakers, I just want to say that today's event is a Zoom meeting rather than a webinar. And what that means is that we can see all of our attendees. So I'd just like to ask you to please keep your cameras on because it's nice to see so many faces, but please keep your microphones muted. Because that will ensure the smooth running of the event. We will have time for questions and answers towards the end of our seminar. And I'd just like to ask you in advance that when it comes to the Q&A, we'd be grateful if you can state your name and affiliation. Okay. Before I hand over to our speakers, just a quick note on upcoming events this term here at the International Inequalities Institute. So next Tuesday at the same time, there will be an event which is held as part of the seminar series on migration, ethnicity and race. And that event will be entitled Racial Discrimination in Hiring, Results from a Harmonized Field Experiment in Germany, the Netherlands and Spain. And it will be delivered by Dr. Javier Polavieja. You can see further details on the talk for next week in the chat function here on Zoom. Okay, without much further ado, I'll now hand over to our speakers. We'll have Professor Laura Baer speak first, followed by Nick Long and then Alpa Shah. They each get 15 minutes and then we hopefully have 15 minutes of Q&A time at the end. Okay, over to you, Laura. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your introduction, Insa. So I've been thinking collectively about this question of the public good and the right to care in the time of COVID-19 since the end of last March, both in my work as part of SPIBE and ethnicity subgroups under SAGE, and as part of a collective of anthropologists in our very own LSE anthropology department here, which included 20 people initially and is now about 10 people working together on these themes. And what we've been trying to bring to the questions of informal and formal care in the UK during the period of tightening and loosening social restrictions is the question of how to apply a social calculus to the measures that are introduced by the government and how to push back critically against them when they don't take into account social support networks, kin work and relations of care, which are so vital to the survival of especially minoritized groups in periods of crisis like this and always. So this is very much a collective project that I'm talking about that is feeding kind of live, more or less successfully and unsuccessfully into policy since last March. So we're all very aware, probably acutely aware of what's happened to care during COVID-19 and if you live in the UK, what's happened to it in the UK. There have been increasing burdens reported by a wide range of organisations, and there's been an outpouring of concern about this in the press and on social media. Homeschooling is one of those burdens, but also there's the burden of caring for elders, children, sick members of households or extended households at a time when formal services have been extremely restricted or inaccessible. But at the same time, we've seen an abundance of care emerging. The widely reported development of mutual aid groups during the first wave. We've got examples of those sort of peppered through our report from these wonderful photographs by Gray Hutton, who's been taking images of these mutual support groups in Hackney and East London in particular. But we're all aware that there's been an abundance of mutual aid developing. So we wanted to look at, as a collective project, both these burdens and abundance and new forms of the public good that were emerging sort of since last March, both at the popular level and then their redefinition through state projects as well. So this work that began all of those months back led us to write a report together that came out this past October, A Right to Care, and I do invite you to go and have a look at that. And I just wanted to let you know some of the key findings that we had within this report, and then to tell you a little bit about our focus now for our second wave of research. Now, one of the things that's really interesting about the first national restrictions and then subsequent local restrictions is that we saw a period in which households were responding really creatively to the constraints of the pandemic policy. As I've already mentioned, of course, national and local lockdowns cut informal care networks abruptly as when households couldn't join up together. And formal care services were also reduced, or they were not trusted by groups of people to follow social distancing guidelines, meaning that networks made collective decisions to turn care inwards. These are the greater burdens of care that we've heard about in terms of reported in terms of mental health issues widely in the press. And many people formed ad hoc and temporary multi-family households in order to meet caring needs. So the numbers of multi-generational and multi-family households increased as people started to take care of each other. And interestingly, our ethnographic research showed that these new inward-looking families had very low trust in the national government, its handling of the pandemic. They felt that they had been abandoned or their essential ties had been broken. And so the legitimacy of government regulations when they didn't address these breaking of ties or they added to the breaking of these ties was hugely reduced. And in particular, in the period over the summer, as the economy and society started to open up, government regulations made little sense to people as they prioritised economy over social values and care. And we saw that in the period of the November lockdown as well, where there was a wider range of retail and workplaces open, families and communities and friendship groups were particularly prevented from associating. The other key finding on this sort of question of burdens is kind of who is bearing the greatest or who has borne the greatest burden during national and local lockdowns. And we found that the squeezed middle of carers had developed and the burdens on young adults in particular had increased, contrary to their representation in much of the press and the discourse on them as people who flout regulations. Within household networks, caring responsibilities were not distributed evenly, and particular groups of people shouldered multiple caring responsibilities or managed multiple households, and others were isolated with those whom they were caring for, forcing to shield themselves. And the mental health impact of this extra burden of care was immense for some, and we think it's the breaking of these ties that's being expressed in the discourse of mental health at the moment. Restrictions have been particularly produced this squeezed middle of middle-aged women who provide physical and financial care to their children and parents, sometimes while continuing as essential workers themselves. And an increasing number of young adults and children were drawn into caring roles, and they're particularly isolated and express concern about their mental health and financial situation. And as I've already said, this runs contrary to public narratives of blame. And of course, this squeezed middle and burden of care is especially a problem in disadvantaged groups, and social restrictions continue to hit them hardest. And this is an issue that we brought to the fore in our collective work in a Spybee paper that I led on back in May, that really argued for prioritising social connections over the opening of the economy and other parts of society. Another finding that we had was that in minority and disadvantaged households, COVID-19 transmission is likely to be linked in part to increased unpaid care. So the invisible labour of kin work was also exposing particular middle-aged and elderly women in South Asian groups to greater risk. And as part of my work with SPIBE and their SISTI subgroups, we've worked collaboratively on qualitative and quantitative research to try and track the health effects of these increased burdens in some of these households and on transmission. And if you're interested in that, you can follow that up with these papers that are on the PowerPoint. And finding five relates really to the formations that are emerging around formal and informal care and starts to pick up on that kind of apparent abundance of care of mutual aid networks and how it's playing out in contemporary Britain. What we found was that in local authority regions where there was well-developed relationships between formal and informal care already, those networks continued during the pandemic and during social restrictions in order to support communities better. So where there were Connor Watts and Jordan Vieira have called in the report stacked formal and informal care, communities fared better under restrictions. And these were also local authorities that had preserved community organisations in spite of austerity funding cuts over the past 10 to 15 years. And these were the places that responded better to the COVID-19 pandemic. And this stacked care of mutual aid and local authority provision produced a very fast network of feedback on hidden needs within society. But we also found that these networks of community support and the brokers to them are particularly fragile, especially if funding is short term and uncertain. And now we're picking up on in our report on a kind of competitive, not quite serious ongoing, but a competitive relationship developing between different community groups at the local level for funding, particularly as that funding remains very fragile and uncertain at present. And we're also concerned by volunteer fatigue potentially setting in, and as it has, if care work in networks such as community champions or these mutual aid groups was unpaid and unsupported by resources in kind. And so I've been pressing within governments, and you can see some examples of that from this 5E paper and within MHCLG, to try and get more funding for more direct funding and resources in kind for mutual aid and other sorts of community networks. Now, the other key finding in our report related to the public culture of the pandemic and the contrast, in effect, between the ways in which particularly disadvantaged communities have come together in mutual aid groups or families and friendship networks have come together in forms of cooperation and mutual support, and that and the political narratives of blame that seem to have dominated throughout the pandemic. The government and politicians, both at the local and national level, seem to have always wanted to identify individuals or groups who are causing transmission and spread in a sort of classically neoliberal move, and to introduce punitive measures to prevent misbehavior, in inverted commas, of the public. But we found in our report that this had led to much greater social divides than actually these sorts of spontaneous affiliation that had emerged at the popular level. And these blame narratives we understand operating at the national level, and to some extent they've also developed at the popular level as well. So there's not only a picture of mutual aid. And that really is emerging from the deep uncertainty of what the disease is, what's happening with it, whether government regulations work. And that uncertainty is operating at all levels of society, generating stereotypes and stigma. And this really had focused down, certainly during June last year, around Eid and around Ramadan, on the problem, in inverted commas, of minoritized groups around the multi-generational household as being a site of transmission, which is not a particular site of transmission, particularly not the wider community, and also now around vaccine equity and vaccine uptake. And we saw this playing out at the local level in a really intense way in Leicester, which was first placed under local lockdown at the end of June. And that led to a massive outpouring of a sense of stigma amongst people in Leicester, and then a dynamic of blame and exclusion in the communities within Leicester, which has since then ameliorated, but is still present. So there's a potential, if we don't get it right, the public culture of engagement, for growing social divides. And you can see some IndySage and SPIBE papers that address that. So now in our project, we've sort of scaled up from this consideration of care and what's been happening to informal and informal care. And I've in particular started to think about, in this next phase of research, about the broader landscape of the public good and how that's transforming in the COVID moment. And I put up here a kind of Jamboard image, which is sort of work in progress on the new constellations that are emerging in this moment of crisis. Crisis is always an opportunity for different sorts of alliances and affiliations and forms of accumulation to occur, and that's what's going on at the moment. So at the sort of top level of this image, although this is all the network joined together, we've got new central government policies that appear to be caring for communities and societies by protecting them from COVID-19. But we also have uncaring government policies, punitive policies, and blame narratives. And then we have at the next level the emergence of new sorts of coalitions, institutions. We have the institution of SAGE itself, the Cabinet Office committees that have been ruling our lives during this past year and are still doing so through forms of lockdown, roadmaps. These are different modes of rule. We've also got new Treasury and DHSC policies, which I haven't had time to go into, but we do analyse those as well. And we've got the emergence of these totally new untransparent institutions like the Joint Biosecurities Centre and the National Health Institute. And we've got these new kinds of policies, particularly centred around community champions in the MHCLG, PHE and NHS. And then at the next level, we've got local authority and NHS mediations of these new forms of the public good and rule, along with the emergence of accumulation in forms of rentier economy, property data procurement and contracts around COVID. And then at the next level down, we've got new sorts of community, both virtual and face-to-face, emerging new forms of mutual aid that are interacting with this new landscape of the public good as it comes through formal networks of government. And we've got new kinds of health and safety rolling out in workplaces. And then at the level of the popular good, we've got both increasing social divides and mutuality, kinship and friendship and supports and also strains on those developing. We've also got chronic burdens of care, experiences of trauma, death, grief and loss, embodied experience of COVID itself and forms of precarity, workplace precarity and forms of precarious care as well. So what I want to explore in the next phase of the research is these new emerging forms of the public good, the legacies of stigma that run at every level of this, and the imaginings of the future and the potentialities of the future that are playing out in the sense of temporality throughout this at every level. So turning back to the question of care, and our first report, we did have several recommendations that I'd like to share with you from that Right to Care report. We wanted the development of COVID-19 policies that particularly supported households, especially the most disadvantaged ones that are still weathering the second wave, and to enable them to renew themselves. And we thought that could initially be achieved by social restrictions that better match the way in which people live and that prioritise the survival of networks, which is still not happening in this roadmap. Also, we had the idea of paying a care wage to compensate for the extra burdens of care during the pandemic. This should be paid to areas like Leicester that have been extended social restrictions, but we could start a national debate about unpaid care, which of course the Women's Budget Group have been doing for decades. The investment also in comprehensive long-term social infrastructures of mutual aid, and the establishment of concrete spaces, local renewal centres that would link social services, mutual aid groups, paid community champions and peer supporters in ways appropriate to the needs of diverse community groups. We also thought that there should be an emphasis on cooperation built by communications and policies that avoid blame, and renewal investment targeted in regions under social restrictions for the greatest length of time. And we're not idealistic about the co-production of decentralized solutions with local authorities and communities, but we think that more of this could be done with the broadest understanding of community, counterintuitive understanding of community. So to do that without romanticizing community solutions. So we hope that, and certainly in this Right to Care report, that we've come up with a social calculus for state provisioning that will sustain inclusive human care and prevent the breaking of relationships that is also part of kinship and care as well. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Laura, for a very rich presentation. Without further ado, I'm going to hand over to Dr. Nick Long for the next presentation. And then to Alpasha before we open up for questions. Nick, over to you.
Thank you very much, Insa, and thank you, Laura, for that great presentation. What I would like to talk about today, it's really taking a lead from what Laura's been saying, is the disconnect between the household as an epidemiological unit of transmission and of disease control, the disconnect between that notion of the household and the networks of really existentially significant relationships, whether that be family or any other network of personal relationships that matter most to people and that need to be preserved during the pandemic. Because the kinds of injunctions that we saw in the United Kingdom, simply stay at home, often ruptured ties that extended beyond the household. And quite aside from placing increased care burdens within the household unit, also meant that certain relationships weren't able to exercise their caring practices in the conventional way or in a way that was necessary to the participants. So as well as being a burden of labour, I think there's also a sense in which that existentially and morally constitutive aspect of care really came under threat, necessarily due to the kinds of pandemic controls that we saw. And that raises the question as to whether or not there might be alternative topologies, different ways of thinking about how to regulate what's going on that might protect those constitutive aspects of our caring relationships. And in that regard, the example of New Zealand was very interesting because rather than having quite the same kind of stay at home instruction that I was living through in the United Kingdom, New Zealand offered a slightly different topology with Jacinda Ardern telling people they had 48 hours to make arrangements. And at that point, where they were living is where they would be living for the foreseeable future. And after that, they would be instructed to stay in their bubble. And so what I'd really like to discuss today is to what extent this topology of the bubble offers a credible or satisfactory policy alternative to the kinds of things that we've been seeing here and what we might learn more broadly from the New Zealand experience. So there are four key features of the bubble that I think are significant and worth drawing out. And the first is that a bubble is something that has to be built. It's not an assumed default location in which one is and in which one stays. Rather, the instruction that came from the government very clearly was build your bubble and you have 48 hours to do it. Now, in some cases, that did mean just staying where you were, but in other cases, it invited you to think about the kinds of needs that you had, the kinds of people that you cared about had, to work in networks to arrange how things were going to be orchestrated so that people could be as supported as possible. And so it was an approach that put care at the core and put principles of self-determination at the core. And in fact, this is very significant in the New Zealand context. The bubble concept was coined by Maori scholar, public health expert with a disability. And so was acutely aware of the importance of self-determination and some degree of agency and control, even if necessarily circumscribed, in being able to move through the pandemic in a satisfactory manner. So what we didn't see in the New Zealand context was the kind of thing that Laura was discussing, where people were having to come up with creative arrangements against the rules and facing the kinds of internal conflicts, the judgment, the stigma, the labelling that came with that. Rather, they had a sanction to do so as long as it was within a particular window. So it was a mode of self-determination that put care at the core. Another key point of Dr. Ingham's bubble concept was that the bubble was something that was beautiful and yet fragile. If you were in your bubble, this sealed, exclusive group of people, and then you approached somebody else, maybe giving them a little hug, it's a bit like if someone hugged a bubble that was floating along the South Bank, it would burst and infection could occur. So there was a sense in the very metaphor of the bubble, that the bubble was something to be cared for. So there was care within, but also care of this topology. And the idea that the bubble was something to be protected and nurtured helped inform people's sensibilities as they were moving through the pandemic and be very attentive to these questions of epidemiology, transmission, and the vulnerability of their bubble mates to their own actions. Another really important aspect of the bubble was that the bubble could be multi-household. It wasn't just a question of getting people to move in with you for the lockdown. At the level four height of New Zealand lockdown. In many cases, being in a bubble did mean all being in the same building, but there were exemptions. So if, for example, you lived alone, it was possible to bubble up with another household so that you could have care and support needs met. If you were a co-parent, then you could pair up into a single bubble. That was the only arrangement of that kind that was allowed in the UK for a very long time. One exception. In New Zealand, also, if you had particular childcare needs, perhaps you were a solo parent, perhaps you had kids who had certain medical needs or were in required various kinds of care support, then you could have a bubble. If one household was made entirely of people who were designated vulnerable, they could have a bubble. So there are various ways to make sure that people were protected that were built into the policy from the start. And then as the number of cases began to fall in New Zealand, what we saw was a broader policy of everyone being allowed to expand their bubble. If, and this was the proviso that was put forward in the government guidance, if doing so was necessary to keep others safe and well. So there wasn't a formal metric on the number of households that could be in this expanded bubble. There wasn't a formal metric on the number of people that could be in the expanded bubble. I mean, at this point, the amount of coronavirus in New Zealand was very low, so that did allow some flexibility. But rather it was the moral and support judgment of the individual citizen that was allowed to determine whether or not a bubble was necessary and for whom. And in fact, what we found in our research was that people were very much using a critical calculus to think closely about who really needed the support. As one of my interlocutors put it, like, by that time we knew who was struggling. It was obvious to know who you were going to bubble with. And so bubbling was not seen as this return to normality. It wasn't seen as the getting to socialize again or having the friends and family list as it was sometimes presented in the British press about a year ago. But rather it was actually seen as the next care act. Having cared for each other by isolating, now through controlled expansion, that was the next stage of care. So what I think was really great about the New Zealand lockdown experience was that it did allow a sense of collective care and a journey of collective caring to be the dominant narrative moving through the pandemic. And that meant that actually people were very judicious about their choices, and not that many people, probably about 50% of our respondents, chose to expand their bubble at level 3 and still in a very controlled way, even at a point where there were no community cases being recorded. So in some ways that goes to allay the concerns that epidemiologists might have about excessive bubbling leading to an increase in transmission, because it shows how if a care calculus is built into the experience of lockdown from the very beginning, then people will start acting in ways that work to offer support but without leading to untrammeled transmission. So it sounds kind of great, doesn't it? And there are a lot of good things about these bubbles, but I'd now like to talk a little bit about the dark side of the bubble and the less positive aspects of each of those four features that I've mentioned. So the bubble appears to offer a sense of self-determination, but one of the problems that we found was that not everybody got to self-determine. The idea of staying in your bubble immediately puts people into a unified collective entity that just didn't match onto the reality of some people's living arrangements, whether that be a household where there were conflicts over who they wanted to connect with. It was seen particularly acutely in the case of people who are in flat share arrangements, where you'd maybe got six people in the same building who didn't even really know each other very well and yet had to find some kind of collective consensus on what they were going to do and how they were going to live. So there were limits. It favoured relatively nuclear family arrangements, even as it was a little bit more flexible than the focus on the nuclear household that we saw in the UK. And the other problem is it requires all the self-determination and anticipation of care needs to be done in advance. So if you know that there is a certain kind of care work that is required to, for example, support an elderly relative with a disability, that can be anticipated. But what it wasn't so good at was providing a responsive mechanism for dealing with the kinds of pressures that would emerge during the pandemic, often as a result of the lockdown itself. So there was still something a little bit unwieldy about the bubble approach that led quite a few of our respondents to go outside the rules and develop more innovative kinds of care, which in this case might mean meeting up outside or going for a physically distanced walk, or the kinds of things that were sanctioned as the lockdown was eased here in the UK, but were never actually sanctioned in New Zealand because outdoor meetings were seen as too much of a transmission risk. I think the fragility of the bubble, the sense that it was something that needed to be protected, could be very empowering, but it could also lead to a lot of paralysis and anxiety. And so we found that there was a double edge to imagining yourself in this very kind of fragile way, where on the one hand, it encouraged people to not take risks and to look after others within their bubble, but it could also lead to a heightened sense of risk that just moving past someone on the street and they got maybe 1 meter close to you, even though that wouldn't count as a close contact for contact tracing, could lead some people to feel that their bubble was burst and they now couldn't support or see their friend in another household because the integrity of the bubble had been compromised. So even as it became a very powerful tool for communicating the risk of transmission, there was also a risk of some people being hyper conscientious in how they internalized the sense of needing to protect others. And this, I think, is a general theme and a policy challenge in responding to the pandemic as a whole, how to get people to take it seriously, but not take it so seriously that actually they might end up self-sabotaging and making life more difficult for themselves and others. So there is still a communications challenge there. And what we also found was that the multi-household bubbles in particular, as they expanded, could often be quite tense. Being together in a bubble was not necessarily the same as reconnecting and going back to the old normal. And while in some ways the bubble could invite a reflection on the novelty of the situation, as the bubbles expanded and the lockdown was seen as being relaxed, that kind of critical sensibility about the new challenges, the kinds of negotiation that living in a bubble required, maybe fell out of view a little bit. And the bubble could also be exclusionary, because there were certain people who just weren't trusted to be brought into an expanded bubble. People who were described as mentally unstable couldn't trust them to be in the closed network. Who knows what they might do when you're not looking? People who were migrants who'd recently arrived and so didn't know anyone to invite them into the expanded bubble. People who were associated with more cultural patterns of collectivism, like Maori and Pacific citizens, were often not trusted. And the key group that were excluded and self-excluded were essential workers, people whose exposure in the workplace, especially a workplace where they couldn't guarantee physical distancing, meant that they were just too much of a risk to include, and so ended up deprived of the benefits that other people got to enjoy. So I think what this really reveals is that although an approach like a bubble can offer benefits compared to simply staying at home, we begin to see how no particular policy, whether that be outdoor meetings only or bubbles only, can really capture the diversity of experiences that are people having during the pandemic. And for me, it's made me think that when we're talking about inequality, it might be important not just to talk about inequality between groups or in established categories of inequality, although that's certainly the case here. So for example, many essential workers in New Zealand are Maori and Pacific, so you get a compounding of disadvantage, but to think about inequality between relationships, that even within one particular network, some relationships might be able to be cared for more than others because of how people are distributed in space, and to really think about how we might be able to come up with a more multi-pronged approach to navigating a lockdown that retains a degree of simplicity, but also allows people a heightened degree of self-determination in how to find ways of caring that match their circumstances. Because in the UK, we are currently in a situation where, despite bubbles being rolled out for increasing numbers of people, there are still many people who've not legally been allowed to have physical contact with anyone outside their household since March, we're now for almost a year. So thinking about how there might be more flexible ways of dealing with these kinds of situations in the future, I think feels like an important priority and something where we can learn from both the strengths and the weaknesses of an approach that appears to be very successful. So I will close on that. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you very much, Nick, for an extremely interesting talk, drawing on your research in New Zealand. Over to you, Alpa, Dr. Alpa Shah, our third speaker for today's event.
Thank you so much. Thank you to Nick and Laura for joining us today. It's so wonderful. I mean, I remember I was in New Zealand when the lockdowns began, and I was stranded there with my three-year-old and my partner, and Nick called me up saying, you know, I'm really interested in what's going on down there, you know, and I was like, yeah, you know, you're right, that, you know, the whole narrative here, you know, that there at the time was completely different. It was about care rather than the economy, which is what dominated back here in England when we returned. And it was wonderful to see Nick developing this research and then come back to England and find Laura doing this amazing work with government pushing, you know, the agenda of social sciences and how we must analyze what's happening right now and pushing government policy in directions which they perhaps might not have gone were it not for her great work. So it's really wonderful to, you know, and I've personally been completely crushed by caring duties over the course of the last 12 months. But in fact, my colleagues with us have given me the inspiration to rethink some of the work that I've been doing for some time in relation to care and inequalities. And I want to present some of this work to you from a very different context to Laura and Nick's presentations. My context is India, and the issue I want to focus on is labor migration, seasonal labor migration. Over the last year or so, our press and our policy debates have remained very UK focused on the devastation that's been caused by the COVID-19 pandemic, the crisis of care, the lockdown measures that we've all had to deal with when we were told to stay at home. But amongst the select international foci that have made it to our TV screens, there was this very compelling imagery that some of you may recall from about a year ago of the millions who had no home to stay in, no home within easy reach, and who just took to their feet when the COVID-19 lockdowns were first announced. And these were migrant workers in India, many of them seasonal migrant workers, usually completely hidden within factory walls, in slum colonies, in places that we'd rather not notice, amidst the shacks on the roadsides. But in March 2020, they were forced onto our news screens because the Indians were given just 4 hours by their prime minister to prepare for weeks, maybe months of being holed in their homes. Several hundred flights were organized through the government's Vande Bharat mission to repatriate thousands of middle-class Indians from one comfort in the world to another back in India. But these 100 million migrants living and working hand to mouth far away from their homes were left to basically fend for themselves. So they had no work, no way to feed themselves, removed completely from their kinship and family support networks. Millions had no choice but to take to their feet to return back to their distant villages. So one after another, they marched, they're carrying their belongings on their backs and on their heads, their children on their shoulders, walking thousands of kilometers, determined to find a way home. And this, you know, captured the imagination of the world for a brief moment in time. It so happened that just after this exodus, Transactions of the Institute of British Geographers published a paper that I had authored with Jens Lerker on our long-standing work on seasonal migration, which shows some of the dimensions of this migration that still remain largely invisible. What you don't see behind the compelling imagery of individual migrant or migrant families taking to their feet, but is central to understanding their exploitation. And it's some of this work which I want to talk about today, in thinking about the conditions and circumstances of the seasonal migrant labor, to add another important dimension of why it is really, really crucial that we center an analysis of the household in any attempt to tackle inequalities. I've actually got some slides. Should I show you some pictures? I don't want it to take up too much time. Hang on a second. Let me see if I can do that. Share. There we go. View. Slideshow. Oh, there we go, you've seen some of those images on our TV screens. So this is where I worked, you know, in Jharkhand, in Eastern India. But there's a lot of anthropologists in this room, but for those of you who are not anthropologists, you know, centering the household and kinship networks is part of everything that we do, because we conduct long-term participant observation amongst the communities that we live with. So it's not just a part of, you know, the household is not just a unit of analysis for us, it's a crucial part of our methodological approach that we champion. But getting to be a part of household structures, the communities we study, and following their kinship networks wherever it takes us is central to any analysis that we produce. And this for me has meant doing all kinds of things, like following kinship networks into guerrilla platoons of the Naxalites, on which my last book was written. But it also took me to the tea plantations of Assam, where my family and friends from the Adivasis, the indigenous people in Jharkhand, who had been taken to pluck tea in the tea plantations, the tea that we drink back here in England, and where they had some kin. But it's also taken me over the years to live with some of my neighbors in the brick factories of the banks of the Hooghly River in West Bengal, where people have been, you know, for years carrying bricks on their heads and shoulders for a few months of the year. And I was particularly interested because the reasons people were going to these brick factories was because they found in these factories a space of freedom to get away from kinship and care networks back at home. And I wrote about this in my first book, In the Shadows of the State, in the last chapter. But over the course of the last decade or so, I've tried to build a wider regional understanding of migration patterns, both in two different field sites in Jharkhand, in the Adivasi forests, looking at why people were migrating, when, to where, with whom, who was left back. And more recently, between 2014 and 2018, in a nationwide program of research with Jens Lerker, several development economists, and a team of five postdoctoral anthropologists, Richard Axelby, Dalal Benbabali, Brendan Donegan, Jayasilan Raj, and Vikram Ditya Thakur, from the anthropology department here, we've been looking at how and why Adivasis and Dalits, you know, previously untouchable groups and indigenous groups in India, remain at the bottom of the social and economic hierarchies despite economic growth. One of the three main issues that comes out in our cross-country research is the importance of the super exploitation of seasonal migrant labor, which allows capitalism in India to entrench the position of India's low castes and tribes at the bottom of the labor hierarchies despite economic growth. So the use and abuse of seasonal migrant labor. And we found migrant labor from Jharkhand, the places where I have worked in Eastern India, in three of our four main research sites in the country, as people who are on the lowest rungs of the labor hierarchy, lower than other social groups in those places. So what I want to highlight to you very, very quickly, because we don't have a lot of time, is some of this analysis of migrant labor and why the household is so important in understanding it, and how the household is important in understanding it. So as we know, you know, big business and industry in India, as elsewhere, really is dependent on migrant labor that is paid less, works longer, harder, and more flexibly than local labor. And everywhere, the people that we worked with had terrible living and working conditions, worse than the worst conditions of the local labor. So, for example, in Tamil Nadu, in the tea factories, in the chemical industrial belt, the local Dalit labor, when they were rising against their terms and conditions of work, the factory owners brought in low caste and tribal labor from Eastern India, from even poorer regions, to undercut that labor force, and who were working in more shifts, 7 days a week, taking turns to sleep on the factory. On the factory floor. In Kerala, where there were Dalit tea plantation laborers, again, they were rising up against their terms and conditions of work. What did the factory owners do? They brought in migrants, seasonal migrant labor from central and eastern India, Adivasis in particular, to undercut the labor power of Dalit laborers. In the Himalayas, the worst terms and conditions of labor was that was done by migrant labor, seasonal migrant labor, again brought from eastern India, building these roads in the high Himalayas, living on tents in the mountains. You know, you can see the conditions of this labor. It's, I mean, really, really appalling. What did we find? Firstly, that there is a strong kind of geopolitical dimension to this work, to these migration patterns. It's these areas of India which have been internally colonized for centuries, Jharkhand, Orissa, Chhattisgarh, which have long suffered from internal colonialism, which are producing migrant labor for other parts of the country. There's a very strong racial or caste dimension to this labor, which is that Adivasi and Dalit labor, those who are at the bottom end of the labor hierarchies, are worst off, are everywhere, you know, worse off in the labor hierarchies. They make up majority of the seasonal migrant labor for workforce, more so than, you know, all other groups. Jan Breyman, the Dutch anthropologist, has done, you know, some of the kind of best work on this migrant, seasonal migrant labor conditions in India, Indonesia, and China. And he once reported that seasonal Adivasi migrant labor, low-caste migrant cane cutters in Gujarat are, as they say about themselves, that even dogs are better off. What's also interesting is how this migrant labor is pitched against each other so that they can't unite. So, you know, Adivasis pitched against Dalits, and you see that kind of pitching of laborers against each other happening, you know, everywhere. You see it right here in England, where first it's the West Indians, then the Indians, and the Eastern European workers who are pitched against the English working classes. And the most important thing that we draw out in this paper is how the seasonal migrant workers are actually supported by a whole invisible economy of care, which is centered around the spatiotemporal division of their households. And here we're drawing very much on the influence of radical feminists, recently revived as social reproduction theory, and the insights of early French migration studies. Well, what our work is showing is that these migrants can only become workers because of the work that is undertaken by generations back at home. So this includes work that is provided by the spouse or the children of the siblings or elderly parents back at home, all of whom are caring for the migrant worker when there is no work, that are keeping the migrants' homes running so that they have a place to return to, who will care for migrant workers in old age when their bodies have been so used by employers that they're no longer fit to work. So these invisible economies of care also in our theory, sorry, I'm just gonna pass over this slide. These invisible economies of care encompass, you know, also the land, the forest, the livestock that provide a livelihood for this kin at home in the village throughout their life cycles. What we argue is that making these economies of care invisible is actually what allows employers, whether in factories, in kilns, or in construction sites, to steal the value of workers and their households, which is what makes them so cheap to employ. So seasonal migrant workers are not only exploited, they're super exploited. So significantly, what the plight of these migrant workers shows us is how capital accumulates on the basis of not only the work in the factories or construction sites or in brick kilns, but on a whole invisible economy of care, which is provided by the family and kin back at home that is never valued. And, you know, so you, those of you, you know, many people in this room will recognize the work of radical feminists who have long been arguing that, you know, we have to look at social reproduction and production together in what constitutes our economy, that we can't separate the two, and that what's central in this is understanding, you know, the place of the household. And what we're arguing here is that in the case of seasonal migrant labor, to understand the full extent of their exploitation, you have to look at the household, not only the household as it may be appear in the place of work, but through the whole entire intergenerational kinship networks and the hidden aspects of the households back in the village. We need to center the spatio-temporally divided household, and this matters for both policy and politics. I will, with that I will end there so that we can open up and have maybe a little time for questions. Sorry for that very, very quick tour through this huge terrain.
Thank you very much, Alpa, for, again, a very rich presentation. So we've got about 8 minutes left, which is not a huge amount of time. I'll start in that case with a question that I can see in the chat function by Rosalind Martin to everyone, although I think the question goes to Nick. I'm going to read it out. Hi, Nick, really interesting talk there, thank you. Do you know of any estimates of the uptake of support bubbles in New Zealand or the UK? For example, percentages of eligible people, individuals or households, or percentages of total population in a bubble? Or perhaps more generally, whether you know of any surveys that have begun to actively collect bubble uptake data but aren't published yet. And this is from Rosalind Martin, who's a data scientist intern at the Leeds Institute for Data Analytics. Nick, do you want to start with that question?
Yeah, well, thank you very much, Rosalind. In terms of New Zealand, we've got some provisional data. It's not from a perfect representative samples, but what we found was that when levels were low and everyone could expand their bubbles, the uptake was little under 50%. But there were skews, so we found the uptake of bubbles was much more likely in households where the respondent didn't have a degree, and when you had a degree or particularly a postgraduate degree, uptake of bubbling was less likely. It's not quite clear what the causal mechanism is there, but so there was some differentiation. In terms of what you say of a support bubble, which would be the kind of buddying for a single person household, what we found was that at least at the beginning of the lockdown, the uptake was relatively low, but then as time went on and the support needs became more acute, people did it. And often people kind of holding back, like waiting to use their bubbling capacity when they needed it or when someone else really needed it. So we got some quite surprising things. I never thought I would form a bubble with this person, but my oven broke and he was the only person I knew who could fix my oven, or I wanted to borrow her washing machine. And then we were like, well, we've exposed ourselves to each other now, let's just form a bubble. So they became my bubble. So often the care thing was quite improvisational if there wasn't a need that could be anticipated in advance. I think in the context of the UK, it becomes very complicated because eligibility for bubbles and who can actually form a bubble has changed over time. So the process of actually kind of tracking levels of uptake and what is affecting that is still ongoing. I don't know if I see Laura has her hand up and may know of some more current ONS or other data for the UK.
Okay, before Laura, I hand over to you, just very quickly, Shalini Grover has also raised her hand. I'm going to give you the floor to ask a question and then pass over to Laura and give Alpa and Nick also a chance to give a final word before we finish. Shalini?
Yes, can you hear me? Okay, well, let me just congratulate all three of you for an absolutely beautiful afternoon, lovely papers, great joy to hear all these different perspectives. I'm also an anthropologist working on the care theme, and I'm at the International Inequalities Institute. Actually, I want to focus more on Nick's notion of the bubble. Nick, these are just a few comments. These aren't really maybe questions, but maybe things to explore further. I actually think theoretically the notion of a bubble is really interesting because you can historically draw, and even in the contemporary times, the Anglo the Anglo-Indian bubble, the expatriate bubble, which is very much being talked about in terms of in anthropology as well. So what I find resonates with the kind of bubble you're talking about is that it seems that these are very supportive networks, but in actuality, they're very inward looking and there's no real moral duty towards the rest of the world because it becomes a very incestuous, inward looking kind of a bubble where you only care for those people. Is that something that you know, you found resonated with you know, New Zealand, where it's a kind of a double-edged thing, you know, which you find with other bubbles that have also been theoretically written about?
Okay, Laura, quickly over to you. We've got 3 minutes. And then I hand over to Nick, then to Alpa, and then we close.
Great. I wanted to answer Shalini's question as well with the same example that both in the UK and anywhere, the uptake of a bubble is a privilege. Certainly looking at the case of Leicester, our recent work shows that families have become divided between areas that are perceived to have high levels of transmission and their more wealthy relatives who live in the more areas outside the city. And so those bubbles or those connections, those network ties have been actively broken. So to have a bubble is a privilege. It means that you're seen as not risky, as Nick's work showed so clearly. So I would fully agree with Shalini's point that, you know, the bubbling is also a process of exclusion, as care was also signaling forms of uncaring. And I think that we need to do more research of that. I've just been doing some work on Leicester analysis that has been looking at that, actually.
Thank you, Nick.
I mean, I think it's a great question. And undoubtedly, there is a degree of insularity because the very notion of the bubble requires a prioritization. And so that's going to lead to people being cut out of view or deprioritized, it's not even thought about. That said, I mean, I think the way in which one relates to this kind of policy possibility can vary. So, for example, there is evidence from New Zealand that within Pacific networks, for example, churches were kind of working together to map how bubbles could be distributed across a whole congregation to work to include people rather than it just coming straight from the kind of the bubble eye view. It was more like a kind of top-down vision of the foam, as it were. In the UK, there's now a provision to change bubbles. So actually, as long as you take a period of 10 days of isolation, which might not suit everyone's arrangements, there's capacity to kind of be a little bit flexible and avoid some of that insularity. So there are ways in which a bubble policy can avoid that risk. But I mean, I think one of the patterns that we've seen throughout the pandemic, certainly in both the UK and New Zealand, is a general insularity of outlook. Anyway, people talking about drifting away from friends, feeling that the lockdown has taken away the substance that has sustained that relationship and being in a kind of a limbo as to whether or not it can return in the new normal. So I think there might be a more general question about how horizons get established and how they could get renewed in the next phase that your question also speaks to.
Thank you, Nick. Alpa.
Thanks. I'd just like to acknowledge a few things. One is that we're hosting this as part of the LSE Inequalities Institute seminar series under the Global Economies of Care research theme. And I want to thank Beverly Skeggs, who had the foresight to set up this theme on the global economies of care long before care became an issue that has taken over our lives. And yeah, so I think it's wonderful that such an important issue was made part central to the study of inequalities at the LSE before we all needed to make it so. And I want to thank my colleagues, you know, Nick and Laura, for doing such amazing work, you know, in this field, and for coming and showing us and presenting giving us a taste of some of this work. There's so many important conversations to have about what is a household, how do we analyze that, and I think that, you know, I can see so many people in this room who are doing that work. So I just wanted to thank you all for coming, and also to INSA for chairing this this session. So yeah, I hope we can continue these conversations over the next years.
Yes, I would just like to, I guess, add to your thanks and also on my behalf, say thank you to everybody for coming along to today's seminar. Thank you to our three speakers. I think what all of you have shown today through your work is the importance of really fine-grained, ethnographic, but also comparative research in improving our understanding of inequalities, but also ensuring that anthropology and social science thinking more generally is not lost in the contemporary moment and really does have a place in shaping politics and policy debates. I think we can't afford to do ivory tower academia in times like today anymore. And I think all of your research shows the importance of that. So thank you so much for today's event. And remember, please do join us again in a week's time for a seminar on racial discrimination in hiring, again at the same time for an hour. Goodbye. Have a good afternoon, everyone.